Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Hydro One Limited third quarter 2017 results investment community teleconference. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. As a reminder, this call is being recorded. I would now like to turn the call over to Omar Javed with the Hydro One management team. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Crystal. Good morning, everyone, and thank you for joining us. I'm here in Toronto with Hydro One's President and CEO, Mayo Schmidt, our Senior Vice President of Finance, Chris Lopez, Greg Torali, our Chief Operating Officer, Ferio Puglis, our Executive Vice President of Customer Care and Corporate Affairs, and Paul Berry, our Executive Vice President of Strategy and Corporate Development. We'll provide some brief comments on our third quarter results and then spend the majority of the call answering as many of your questions as time permits. There are also several slides which illustrate some of the points we'll go over in a moment. They should be up on the webcast now, or if you've dialed in to the teleconference, you can also find them on Hydro One's website in the Investor Relations section under Events and Presentations. As the discussion this morning will likely touch on estimates and other forward-looking information, you should review the cautionary language in today's earnings release and our quarterly MD&A, which we have filed this morning regarding the various factors, assumptions, and risks that could cause our actual results to differ, as they all apply to this call. With that, I will turn the call over to Mayo Schmidt.
Thank you, Omar, and good morning, everyone. Our team is quite excited to have the opportunity to talk about our third quarter results. Let me start by providing a review of the quarter and where we are in our transformation as a North American leading utility. We have introduced innovative productivity programs in our operations with a strong focus on customer advocacy and the success of new initiatives enhancing and materially improving our relationship with all customers. Greg is prepared to discuss productivity initiatives. Additionally, Ferio is keen to highlight a number of high-impact customer initiatives during our discussion to follow this morning. Chris will follow my comments today to provide our analysis of the financial results. The positive results that we saw this past quarter reflect retroactive revenues from the transmission rate decision, as well as our significant momentum in two key areas: using innovation to improve productivity and reliability, and the introduction of customer-centric programs designed to improve our customers' experience while driving our accounts receivable to lower levels. There's some key operational highlights from the quarter include the growing productivity savings being achieved through our new vegetation management approach, our fleet optimization project, and the execution of a more competitive procurement process. As you will recall, these initiatives, which arose through our comprehensive analysis of Hydro One's operating platforms and customer service businesses on the arrival of the new leadership team. In our focus on operational excellence, Greg's teams are leveraging innovation and targeted investments to transform and modernize our system to achieve productivity savings. We've introduced a new condensed vegetation management program that will result in immediate unit cost productivity savings through a more surgical approach and selective clearing of vegetation, and will, over the long term, reduce the total program cost after clearing much of the heavier vegetation through the first tree trimming cycles. We expect to achieve long-term productivity savings as well as improve reliability and community relations. This approach will target high-growth areas in our territories, areas with strong likelihoods of causing an outage. Our intent is to shorten the vegetation cycle to every 3 years, down from every 10 years. At the same time, we are leveraging telematics data to evaluate equipment utilization and productivity of the company's fleet in order to identify opportunities to reduce fleet size. So far, the fleet component has been identified as being reduced by potentially 10% or as many as 800 units, with several hundred to be removed from inventory over the balance of 2017 and continuing disposals into 2018. Going forward, we will continue to leverage our telematics to continue removal of units through logistics planning, improvements in our dispatch and logistics programs, further rationalizing equipment while improving productivity levels, allowing greater safety, reduced maintenance costs, and a reduction in our carbon footprint. Savings were also achieved through our strategic sourcing program designed to refocus our procurement strategy and leverage our $1 billion in spend annually across 18 materials and service categories. We have already successfully reduced the price for procured materials and services by consolidating spending to exercise purchasing power and by introducing a revised, more streamlined bidding process. I am proud to report that Hydro One teams are successfully demonstrating a strong commitment for operational excellence and commitment to safety. Our crews demonstrated their expertise, hard work ethic, and safety record during several big storms this quarter, both in Ontario and during the restoration effort in Florida. Through our unique relationship with peers internationally, Hydro One mobilized 175 employees to Florida to restore power to people in desperate need of help after Hurricane Irma hammered the state of Florida, causing extensive damage and losses. Over a period of 14 days, Hydro One crews made the round trip to Miami, Florida, and restored power to over 10,000 Florida Power and Light customers. During our time in Florida, our employees were assigned challenging work in extreme heat conditions. Above all else, every crew member lived our core values and demonstrated how we work together to help others in need. The team earned the admiration and public recognition among their peers, the public, and the state administration involved in the rescue efforts in Florida. Now further, on the customer front, Ferio's teams have been listening, focusing, and acting on customer preferences. We have introduced programs and policies that deliver maximum benefit at minimal cost to ratepayers. The execution of these programs, many of which have been profiled in previous quarters, serve to improve our customer experience, build our relationships with those we serve while reducing our service and bad debt costs. We have now enrolled nearly 90,000 residential and small business customers in the continued uptake of our enhanced paperless billing service, customized high usage alerts, and billing arrival notification. While this enhances the convenience for customers, it also serves to reduce our billing and our postage costs. Additionally, to make e-billing even easier, we launched a new mobile-friendly website offering streamlined self-service features to meet evolving needs of our customers. Overall, customers are pleased with the new website and self-service features. Initial results are positive, with increased usage of the website and self-service portal. I am also pleased to report to you that billing accuracy continues to surpass Ontario Energy Board requirements, achieving to date 99.25%. We continue to advocate for the customer. Hydro One's leadership and board of directors support the recent launch of the Affordability Fund, a relief program of up to $200 million in funding paid for by the province of Ontario and administered by Hydro One. This is a program that Hydro One advocated for, which helps all customers who do not qualify for low-income programs but need assistance to make energy-efficient home improvements to bring down their monthly electricity bills. This year's winter relief program builds on the leadership position Hydro One took last year by proactively reconnecting hundreds of families across Ontario living without power during the cold Ontario winters. Following Hydro One's proactive leadership and reconnections in 2016, the Ontario Energy Board recently mandated winter reconnections for those Ontario customers that have fallen behind on their accounts, a decision which supports and we applaud. We are committed to continuing to provide support and relief to customers, especially at a time when they need it most. Now lastly, Hydro One continues to be recognized for our leadership position at the provincial and national levels. In September, Hydro One was awarded Leader of the Year by our peers with the Ontario Energy Association. We were also recognized by the Canadian Council for Aboriginal Business for our commitment to Indigenous Canadians and communities in their Progressive Aboriginal Relations Program. This designation follows committed participation in the Progressive Aboriginal Relations Program and an external validation of corporate performance in Aboriginal relations. This program recognizes the company as a good partner, a great place to work, and a champion for the prosperity of our Aboriginal communities, businesses, and individuals. Now, as we discussed in the call last quarter, we're very excited to combine with Avista to create a North American utility leader with a $34 billion enterprise value. This is a strategic acquisition of a high-quality, regulated transmission and distribution utility top leadership team in the U.S. Pacific Northwest, which will place Hydro One in the top 20 North American utilities, a truly historical achievement for Hydro One. In the first full year post-close, we expect the merger will be accretive to EPS. In the longer term, we expect to see increased opportunities for innovation, research, and development, and the efficiencies by sharing technology, best practices, and business processes over a broader customer base and set of infrastructure. On September 14th, Hydro One and Avista Corporation marked a major milestone in the proposed transaction when we filed joint applications to request regulatory approval of the proposed merger. The applications have been filed, as expected, with state utility commissions in all five states, Washington, Idaho, Oregon, Montana, and Alaska, as well as with the U.S. Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, FERC. FERC approval is likely to proceed as no comments or requests for formal intervention were received by the deadline, and given lack of opposition, the decision may be made in early January 2018. In early October, Avista Corporation also filed the preliminary proxy for shareholders' approval of the merger with the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. In the coming months, we will file additional applications with a number of other American agencies, including the Federal Communications Commission and the Committee on Foreign Investments in the United States. The leadership and regulatory teams of both Hydro One and Avista are laser-focused on a high-quality filing and an efficient process to achieve our stated outcome. This is our top priority. It is also important to note the success of the Canadian bought deal offering associated with the Avista transaction. Investor enthusiasm and strong demand for both retail and institutional customers, investors, resulted in oversubscription of the approximately $1.5 billion of convertible debentures. The securities sold out in overnight and were two times oversubscribed, a testament to the high level of investor support for the Avista transaction. The energy landscape is rapidly changing, and Hydro One must be positioned as a leader to launch innovative solutions, new business, and growth. At the same time, the company will continue to focus on strengthening its core business for the benefit of its shareholders, customers, communities, and its people. By leading in customer service, operational excellence, and innovation, we will ensure Hydro One is recognized as a North American leading energy company. Now, with that, I'll turn the call over to Chris for some additional color on the financial results, and then we'll stand by for questions.
Thank you, Mayo, and good morning, everyone. I'm pleased to report that EPS for the quarter was 37 cents. After adjusting for one-time impact of the Avista transaction, the adjusted EPS is 40 cents, which is a 2.6% increase over last year. The transmission rate decision and positive cost performance after adjusting for one-time costs related to the Avista transaction drove favorable results this quarter, which were partially offset by a lower ROE and the impact of milder weather. Our third quarter revenue net of purchase power was higher by 1.3% year over year. This is reflective of the decision on our 2017-18 transmission rate filing on September 28, 2017, coupled with a few factors that have been impacting results all year. The transmission rate decision resulted in increased revenue of approximately $55 million, which represents catch-up revenue earned during the first, second, and third quarters of this year. This includes higher disposition of certain OEB-approved variance accounts, higher export service credits, and higher rate revenues. The acquisition of Hydro One Sault Ste. Marie in the fourth quarter of last year also contributed to higher transmission revenue. The upswing in transmission revenues resulting from the rate decision were largely offset by the impact of milder weather in the quarter, which affected peak demand. The average monthly Ontario 60-minute peak demand was 9.3% lower this quarter compared to the same period last year. Distribution revenues were also impacted by the milder weather as consumption levels declined. Lastly, as noted in the previous two quarters, the OEB-approved allowed return on equity was formulaically adjusted downwards late last year, reflecting the prevailing interest rates at that time. The allowed ROE declined from 9.19% in 2016 to 8.78% in 2017, which resulted in lower earnings for both the distribution and transmission segments. Since then, these rates have been steadily increasing. If we were to calculate the ROE today based on the formulaic mechanism, which includes the current long bond rates and utility spreads, the ROE would be approximately 9%. On the OM&A front, costs this quarter increased by 4.9% from last year. This increase is mainly due to isolated factors, and once normalized, the OM&A levels are actually 3.8% lower year over year. Although we spoke about the Avista acquisition last quarter, the transaction actually occurred during the third quarter. As a result, we have recognized related non-recurring consulting costs, which contribute to the increase of $25 million of OM&A costs in the other segment. Within our distribution segment, OM&A decreased by 6.9%. It is important to note that included in our distribution OM&A for this quarter are the storm restoration costs associated with Hurricane Irma, restoration efforts in Florida, which are fully recovered in revenue, with no impact to net income. Adjusting for this item, the distribution OM&A would have been lower by approximately 11.3%, which reflects operational improvements such as the vegetation management initiative discussed by Mayo earlier on this call. Below the operating cost line, we had similar factors affecting our results as in prior quarters this year. An increased weighted average long-term debt portfolio, including long-term debt assumed as part of the Hydro One Sault Ste. Marie acquisition, resulted in higher financing charges, and increased depreciation was due to rate-based growth. Also affecting financing charges this quarter was an increase in interest of approximately $8 million on the convertible debentures issued in August, which were sold to satisfy the equity component of the Avista acquisition. Following the end of the quarter, in October, we entered into a deal contingent foreign exchange forward agreement to convert 1.4 billion Canadian to US dollars. This agreement mitigates the foreign currency risk related to the portion of the acquisition purchase price financed with convertible debentures. The contract can be executed any time up to March 31, 2019, and the deal contingent fee could be in the range of $27 million to $47 million. Moving over to investing activities, assets placed in service are lower this quarter, which is also affecting the year-to-date comparison. While distribution assets placed in service are up by 8.9% this quarter, transmission assets placed in service are down significantly from the prior year. There were a number of large transmission projects that had significant portions put into service during the third quarter of 2016, including the Guelph Area Transmission Refurbishment Project, the Toronto Midtown Transmission Reinforcement Project, and the Richview Transmission Station Circuit Breaker Replacement Project. Capital investments of $380 million were made during the quarter. In the transmission business, the amount of capital investments was similar to last year as we continued our investments in three major transmission stations: a new transmission station in Clarington, the rebuild of a critical switch yard supporting the Bruce Power nuclear facilities, and the Leamington transmission station, which will serve load growth in the Essex County. In the distribution business, capital investments are lower than the prior year as we attempt to manage our rate base additions over 2016 and 2017 to align to OEB approved levels. As a result, the year-over-year change is related to the work that was started in 2016 and is completing in 2017. In terms of our regulatory updates, on the transmission side, as mentioned earlier, we received a decision from the OEB during the quarter on the 2017-2018 rate application that we had filed back on May 31, 2016. As a reminder, this was a two-year cost of service filing, and the next transmission filing, which we expect to make in the second quarter next year, will be a five-year filing under the OEB incentive-based regulatory framework for the 2019 to 2023 period. Following the decision, we filed a draft rate order and on November 9 received a subsequent decision which confirms the revised revenue requirement and reflects the impacts of the OEB's decisions, including a reduction in OM&A expense of $15 million related to compensation, a reduction of $31 million in income tax expense related to the deferred tax asset, and a reduction to capital expenditures of $126 million, among others, for the 2017 rate year. On October 18, 2017, we filed a motion to review and vary portions of the decision that give rise to the reductions in the improved revenue requirement. This included objections that a portion of the tax savings resulting from the Government of Ontario's decision to sell its ownership interest in Hydro One Limited and its subsequent IPO should be applied to reduce the revenue requirement, and that costs related to the Ombudsman's Office should not be included in rates. On October 27th, we also filed an appeal of the decision to the Ontario Divisional Court, which has stayed pending the outcome of the OEB review and variance motion. The revenue recorded this quarter for the transmission decision was calculated using a revenue requirement that was inclusive of 100% of the tax savings resulting from the Government of Ontario's decision to sell its ownership interest in Hydro One. We believe the OEB's direction to include only a portion of these savings in the revenue requirement was based on four principal errors in the tax savings determination, which are clearly articulated in Hydro One's positions filed. On the distribution side, we filed a blue page update on June 7th to the 2018-2022 distribution rate application, which resulted in lowering the average annual impact on distribution rates over the five-year term from an increase of 3.7% to an increase of 3.5% per annum. The OEB later issued correspondence indicating that the timing and key dates leading up to the oral hearing had been postponed and that schedule changes would be provided at a later date. We look forward to engaging with the OEB and demonstrating our position. At this time, we cannot estimate when a decision would be anticipated. In terms of financial strength, we continue to have a very strong balance sheet with conservative leverage and strong investment-grade credit ratings. Our weighted average cost of debt is a low 4.3%. Our redemption schedule is fairly smooth with an average term of 15.1 years, and we have significant liquidity. As previously mentioned, we completed the sale of $1.54 billion convertible unsecured subordinated debentures on August 9th as part of the Avista financing strategy. These convertible debentures are represented by installment receipts that trade on the Toronto Stock Exchange. I'll stop there, and we'd be pleased to take your questions.
Thank you, Mayor and Chris. We'll ask the operator to explain how she'd like to organize the Q&A polling process. Please go ahead, operator.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question at this time, please press the star and then the number one key on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered or you wish to remove yourself from the queue, please press the pound key. Once again, to ask a question, please press star and then one now. And our first question comes from Mona Nazir from Laurentian Bank. Your line is open.
Good morning, and thank you for taking my questions. So the first question I had is just related to the $18 million in Avista-related costs. How do we expect that to trend, or how do you expect that to trend into Q4 and as we get into 2018, closer to the closing date?
Hi, Mona. It's Chris Lopez here. So the cost that were reflected there was the cost of the success fee for the bankers and some of the advising fees that were early in the process. So I wouldn't expect it to continue at that rate into Q4. However, it will have an uptick towards the end of the transaction as we move into the more detailed part of the regulatory filings and the hearings. So I'd expect it to pick up in Q1 and into Q2 and Q3 next year when the deal is closed.
Okay. And just touching on the recent OEB transmission decision, in the history of the company, have you ever had to appeal, either appealing directly to the OEB or going through this kind of court appeal process?
No, this is Mayo. No, we have not. This is this would be a new event for the organization, but we feel strongly about our position. The communication between the organizations has been clear, and frankly, I don't think unexpected by the OEB in any case.
Okay. And just lastly for me, before I step back, the diversification brought on by Avista on both a geographic basis and new vertical. I know it's still early days in the process, but I'm just wondering your thoughts on how to capitalize on your new footprint. And do you expect much change to the business mix and geographic reach over the next 5 years, or do you kind of visualize keeping with what you see now? And that's assuming Avista closes.
Yeah, thanks, Mona. I would just start with the point we We have a strong view that the regulatory process will be efficient, that it'll be a successful outcome. Secondly, is we see opportunities in a number of areas, whether it's procurement or IT services, et cetera, to share in the productivity and efficiency between the two organizations. And of course, the leverage that comes with the collective balance sheet to the two organizations positions us to be, I think, strong in terms of procuring what is hundreds of thousands of poles and thousands of miles of wire, et cetera. The thing that I think we embrace most about the transaction is not only the quality of the leadership team, but really two other key components. One is it's a company that has a deep history of innovation that goes back over 100 years, and you may be aware that they actually own the patent of the first electric stove is how far back their innovative history goes, and they've had a considerable number of successes that will complement the work that we're doing on innovation here. And I think also we think about when you talk about verticals, this is a really unique opportunity to not only buy a fully regulated business in the transmission and distribution businesses, which is of course a core competency for our organization, but also it gives us a really nice exposure, which we have skills in on the gas distribution and also on generation that's a renewable such as the hydroelectric. So we're buying really deep value, long-term assets that should continue to produce year after year after year over the next century. So we're quite excited about that. And at the same time, the size of the new opportunities, which is of course gas distribution, is very much appropriate considering the weight of the business relies in the transmission distribution. So we like the exposure, we like the size of it, and frankly, it's the business of Vista is large enough that it's very meaningful, but it's not so large as to be any kind of a distraction from both overall running of the business here in Ontario, but also the gaining the efficiencies of the collective organizations.
Thank you. That was very helpful.
Yeah, thanks, Mona.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Andrew Kuske from Credit Suisse. Your line is open.
Thank you. Good morning. The question might be for Chris, and it's just on the OM&A reductions, and I appreciate the detail you went into, but if we could talk maybe a little bit more about just the OM&A. So on an overall basis, it's obviously up, but it's skewed by the $33 million in other, which includes a lot of the Avista costs. But if you drill into, say, distribution in particular, your costs are down. So what's the dynamic there, and what part is really timing versus structural?
So when I split out the one-time events, my comments were around the overall OM&A costs are down 4%, and that is structural, if you strip out the one-time events. And structural is really being driven by vegetation management and reduction in our head office costs. And the two events that you strip out for that really are the Avista transaction, and there was the cost associated with a Florida hurricane that have recovered in it's one time, and it was recovered in revenue, and that's approximately $7 million.
Okay, that's helpful. And then just on the vegetation management, if we could maybe get into a little bit of just the dynamics there, is it sounds like you've truncated the old schedule of vegetation management to something a bit shorter in duration and maybe being a bit more aggressive in going out and tackling certain issues. And obviously that has knock-on effects into productivity, reliability. But are your expenses more front-end loaded, and then you really reap the benefits of that on a longer-term basis?
Yeah, so this is Greg Corrale, Chief Operating Officer. So we've just undergone the commencement of this new vegetation management program. Based on a lot of best practices of U.S. utilities and other Canadian utilities, and it moves that cycle from a 10-year time frame to a 3-year. So we're going to accomplish more circuit kilometers of clearing, but we're going to be more surgical in our approach. So we're not going to do a complete clearing, but we're going to clear the vegetation that has the most significant impact and potential for an outage on our system. So when we do that, of course, we reduce the unit cost because we're covering circuit kilometers, many more circuit kilometers with this new approach. We're still going to need a significant amount of dollars, the dollars that we submitted in our rate case application, for the first couple of years because we're going to be removing a lot of dead, dying, and diseased trees that could fall into our lines based on this new approach. And then over the long term, after we get through a cycle or two and much of that heavier vegetation is weeded out, then we'll be able to achieve total cost savings that'll be on the decline in the out years. But immediate unit cost savings up front and then total cost savings over the long term.
Okay, that's very helpful. Thank you.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Rob Hope from Scotiabank. Your line is open.
Yes, good morning, everyone. Just starting off south of the border with Avista, and I realize it's early days, but any thoughts on potential implications of U.S. tax policy changes there, either pro or con?
Hi, so Chris Lopez here. So it's very, very early days, as you just pointed out, and I think the only item that was of any significance that came out was the suggestion that the tax rate would be cut to 20%. So that would have a cent or so, up to 2 cents impact on the accretion, but we would find a way to manage that. And again, it's very, very early days, and that's without any optimization. So we'll continue to monitor it and look at it and see how we can offset any impact of a change in tax breakdown there.
All right, that's helpful. And then moving back north of the border, just when looking at Q3, just to help us understand, so the 40 cents that you booked, I guess, was inclusive of the transmission decision for all aspects except for the tax changes there. And then just want to get a sense of how much of a magnitude that would have been during the quarter.
Yes. So you summarized it correctly, and the magnitude during the quarter is approximately $50 million.
Okay, thank you. And then just in terms of timing, when would you expect to get this review and variance application or court challenge finalized or to completion?
I would say that one is over the course of the balance, which we only have a couple months left in the year we're in, is the process will begin. I expect the first quarter there will be a lot of activity, but it would not be predictable to say that it's going to happen in the first quarter or first two quarters, but I think just using a reasonable judgment, the expectation would be, if anything, it would be late in the first quarter or potentially into the second. And you know, if we can use history as a guide, of course, the ruling we just received on the transmission filing was, again, retroactive to January 1st. So that's the information that we have, and it's early days in the process. But as I mentioned earlier, Rob, it was not unexpected that, in fact, we would be responding in the way that we have with the OEB would be our information.
I appreciate the color. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Rob.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Jeremy Rosenfield from Industrial Alliance. Your line is open.
Yes, thank you. Just a couple of questions. First, I'm curious if you have heard anything as to why the OEB has not yet published its update for the ROE officially, and if there has been any indication to you specifically as to when they may publish that.
Hi, Jeremy. It's Chris Lopez here. So we haven't heard anything specifically, but we anticipate we'll have that update within the next 2 weeks. As we've indicated previously, it's formulaically calculated, so it's not a matter of interpretation. It's just a matter of publishing.
Yeah, that's I'm aware of that. Just in the past, they have typically published it within October, and now it seems later. So I was wondering if there had been any, you know, implication as a result of that. But if not, that's very good. Just moving forward from a more maybe broad perspective, looking at the Ontario Long-Term Energy Plan, which was published recently, are there any takeaways that you can highlight for us from the plan that, you know, would lead into how you are going to develop the business going forward?
Hi, Jeremy. It's Ferriel here. We are taking an extensive review of the long-term energy plan. It is certainly based on input from industry across Ontario. At first blush, we believe that there's certainly opportunities there, you know, with what has been suggested with additional FIT contracts and green energy initiatives. But we continue to do a deeper dive into, you know, what other potential there is for us to see initiatives for innovation that would apply to the business. It's the third volume of documents that have been produced in Ontario, and what we feel with this plan is it actually gives some sense of certainty to cost and program certainty over the long term. So we're continuing to peel through it. You know, time will tell here in the coming months as to what opportunities we evaluate that we feel we can add commercial value to the business with.
Great. That's it for me. Thank you.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Linda Ezergailis from TD Securities. Your line is open.
Thank you. I'm still going through your results, so I apologize if some of my questions have been addressed in your write-up. But I'm just wondering maybe when you talk about some of the initiatives you're taking around vegetation, fleet management, and procurement, notionally for each of those buckets, how might we think of the relative proportion of benefits being in your distribution versus the transmission business?
Greg Corrali here. I would say most of those productivity initiatives are in our distribution business. Certainly there are some in our transmission business as well. And all of those collectively, those initiatives have really helped us achieve the financial results that we reported here today.
And so how much more would you say would there be left to go? Are you three-quarters of the way there? Or?
Well, we're on track right now to achieve our forecasted savings for the year, and we build productivity savings into our budget, as we have in our five-year distribution rate case moving forward, as well as we're going to in our transmission rate case. So both shareholders and customers are going to benefit from these productivity savings, but we're on track to achieve our targeted savings for the full year of 2017.
Okay, thank you. And just a follow-up question with respect to your accounting treatment of the transmission decision. For the fourth quarter, how will you be booking your financials both for your kind of ongoing operations, and will there be maybe a one-time impairment charge related to tax or an adjustment to FFO on the annual basis that you disclosed in your write-up, or would that decision be made to make that change once a final resolution comes, either from a review and variance decision or an appeal, and how are your accountants advising that you approach that?
Hi, Linda. It's Chris here. It's the latter of what you proposed there or what you indicated. So we remain of the opinion that it's probable that we will prosecute our case to success. And while that remains true, we would defer any impairment until such times as that became it would change. And that could be in the event of the decision, or it could be other facts that come to light. Likely it would be the decision in the motion to review and vary that would set that out. So that's where it would be, and the accounting is set out in the notes and the MD&A. It talks about a one-time impairment in the event that we are unable to defend our position. And then going forward, it also, in the MD&A, highlights the impact of the FFO going forward.
Sorry, so the FFO will not – how will you be booking cash flows? Because your FFO does go down as your new rates come into effect, do they not, or do you reverse that back and normalize for that?
Yeah, so the new rates have come into effect, and the rates that we are accounting on is we expect to recover the full amount of the tax benefit at this point. So at the point where that is no longer true, we would book a one-time impairment, and then the FFO would be reduced at that point.
Okay, maybe I'll follow up offline with Omar, if that's okay.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Robert Kwan from RBC Capital Markets. Your line is open.
Good morning. If I can just follow on the financial impact. So if the RNV is unsuccessful, you've laid out the $50 to $60 million annual FFO impact. Just wanting to drill down into the buildup of that figure. So does that include a similar impact on the distribution side of the business?
Yes.
Okay, so is that really just the buildup of, I think you outlined, depending on the year, let's call it $25 million of tax on the transmission side. That assumes the full $15 million OM&A disallowance with no mitigation, and then call it high teens on the distribution side of things? On the tax?
Yeah, so the FFO impact that is outlined in the MD&A is purely related to the tax. In regards to the other impacts, we will look at ways to recover that internally within our business.
Okay.
By reducing corporate overhead or whatever that needs to be.
Got it. Okay. And then from the earnings side of things, how do you expect that to play through? Is the tax an actual impact on the income statement, or is that going to be swept away via rate-regulated accounting?
No, today there is no impact because we remain of the opinion that we can defend the position that it will be recovered. At the point where that is no longer true, then there will be a one-time write-off, a one-time hit to earnings, and in the MD&A we set out what that range is based on the current ownership and the calculation put forward by the OEB. That could be for the distribution and the transmission business up to $885 million as a one-time impairment charge with no further impacts on net income after that.
Right.
However,
go ahead, Chris.
Yeah, however, there will be an impact on FFO because we won't be collecting the higher rates going forward.
Okay. So the ongoing impact to earnings is zero, but that's because of rate-regulated accounting principles?
As we sit today, yes.
Okay, that's great. The last question I've got is you've got a disclosure about insourcing of the back office, and we've seen with some others who've done this has been a positive event given rate-based investment to set up the operations. Is that the case here?
Can you provide some more clarity when you talk about back office?
So I think there's a disclosure that you've got an outsourced customer service or function that contract expires at the end of the year and you're going to be insourcing the operation.
It's Barrio here. I can take that question. Yeah, we are just working through the process with bringing the call center operation, our customer service operation, back in-house and insourcing it. And this has been based on discussions and negotiations that we've had with both of our unions, the PW and Society, and have been able to reach arrangements that are cost-effective and flexible, allow us to insource that at a lower cost structure and a declining cost structure basis. Right now, as we've moved to more flexible channels by using and opening up digital channels for e-billing and so on, it's reducing call volumes into our call center, bringing the call center back in through those lower call volumes and now at a declining rate of cost per call gives us the price flexibility and the cost advantage of operating a more efficient call center on our own. But in addition, this speaks to some of the points that Mayo made in his opening remarks about us also driving for a greater quality of experience with our customers. The intent with the insourcing of the call center as well is we've obtained through our contract negotiations with both the PW and the Society is flexible work terms that allow the call center agents now to work just beyond the basics of entertaining customer escalations and complaints. We can actually now use the call center agents to expand the level of service they're providing. And if we were to get into other commercial arrangements or sell other services, we could now use that call center to do as such. So we view it as a strategic advantage. It gives us the control over the customer experience better than we have today at a better cost price point, and in addition, delivering a better quality of service to our customers.
Right. So, but is there a capital cost of, you know, setting up the infrastructure to handle all of this?
No, there is no.
Okay.
There is no capital cost. We own the facilities and have for years. And in essence, what we'd be doing is just, in essence, terminating the contract with our outsourcer insourcing that contract, and with the new terms and conditions, we're actually insourcing it at a lower cost base.
Got it. So it's just, it's a people OPEX situation.
That's exactly right.
Excellent. Okay. Thank you very much.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Robert Catellier from CIBC Capital Markets. Your line is open.
Hi, good morning. I wondered if you could discuss, based on your initial contact with the regulators and stakeholders about the Avista acquisition, what your sense is of the required concessions or contributions that you need to make to have the deal approved, and compare those to your accretion expectations?
Let me take that. So maybe there's two levels to answer that question. One being that, this is Mayo, I've met with the commissioners of four out of the five states, and I intend to meet with the fifth one this month in the next week and a half. I would say that the meetings were very constructive, very positive, and quite frankly, quite welcoming. And I say that was two reasons. One is the activities of this organization over the last years, specifically 2 years, have demonstrated a real strong customer focus, which is important, the activities that they embrace, and secondly is bringing a organization with the not only the good reputation but also the balance sheet that Hydro One has been seen as highly attractive to the states, both the governors that I've met and also the state commissioners. It's early yet, and we just filed in mid-September, and October was a period of time where there were a lot of questions being answered. So we've received from different states different numbers of questions, but some substantive question requests, which under Jamie Scarlett, the team is executing on those responses. We've got a very strong regulatory team both here at Hydro One and at Avista that are working collaboratively. So we don't think it's an exercise that's going to be too arduous for us. We don't know at this period of time yet what the expectation of net benefit will be. But at the same time, we have recognized there needs to be one, and we will be providing with, and we haven't counted our view within the accretiveness of the transaction. There is a recognition of what our expectation may be, of what their request ultimately will be, and we expect by next quarter we'll have more clarity on that, Robert.
Okay, that's helpful. And then we haven't had an update, I think, on the CFO search, so can you just give a quick update there, please?
Happy to. So as you would expect, the organization has done an extensive search, looking in Canada and also in the U.S. And I would say that I've met with a number of candidates. I've got more to meet with. We've surfaced some very high-quality individuals. We're in the process now of narrowing to a short list over the next course of the next few weeks, and including this week and next. I'll be meeting with candidates. And I would say that my goal and the goal of the board of directors and the full leadership team here is to hire attract and retain a high caliber candidate that is in fact has the competencies of the leadership team that we built around here at Hydro One, which I think is quite strong. And so I think it's a combination of both the personality fit but also a competency fit. And I think I like what I'm seeing as we've narrowed now down into a shorter list. And Judy McClure, who is the Chief Human Resource Officer, and I are working through that list, and we'll get to a conclusion here, I think, in the coming, I think in the balance of this year would be the expectation, assuming that people are available to complete the interviews.
Okay, my last question then is on the actual tax rate in the quarter. Maybe, Omar, this is something we could take offline, but it was a year-over-year decline. So is there any obvious explanation for that?
Yeah, Rob, happy to touch base with you and provide you with more color on the effective tax rate. I believe you're correct in your assessment.
So not, you don't think it's likely to continue? It's just timing issues or something like that?
I,
So Chris Lopez here. We've had a number of tax returns that have been completed. We have provisions against some of those tax returns, so we're able to clear those provisions now. So it's a one-time benefit, if you like. So you'll see the rate stay within the range that we expected, that we put out there, the 14-16%, but for the quarter it was low. That's correct.
Got it. Thank you.
Thank you. And we do have time for a couple of more questions. Our next question will come from Linda Ezergailis from TD Securities. Your line is open.
Thank you. Wanted to understand more the FFO effect of 50 to 60 million and the assumptions behind that. Just to clarify, it's transmission and distribution potential tax effects if you're not successful in your appeal. What is the assumption in terms of ownership of the public versus the government? Would this go down with the dilution from the Avista shares once that transaction closes, or is that number already reflecting a higher share count, or is that not a factor?
Hi, Linda, it's Chris. Yes, on all counts. So you summarize it very clearly. It currently reflects the decision that the OEB has put on file, which is at the lower provincial, at the higher provincial investment amount. Once they're diluted further and they can go down to 40%, and they're currently at the 51 in that calculation, this amount will go down. The write-off will go down, and the FFO impact will also go down.
So what would will this number be once the Avista transaction closes and those shares get converted?
Yeah, so there's two pieces to that. There's the Avista transaction themselves, and there's a commitment from the government, provincial government, to sell shares to First Nations and unions. If both events occur and it takes them down to 41%, the write-off will drop by $150 to $200 million, and the FFO impact would go down by 15 to 20%.
Okay, thank you. And just a follow-up, bigger picture question maybe for Mayo. There is a provincial election next year. I'm wondering if you have engaged the various parties or if you're aware what their platform is with respect to electricity policy and how it might affect Hydro One, if at all, if any of the different parties were to come.
Sure, Linda. Thank you for that. It's a very, very interesting question. I would say one is we have and do engage with them, and let me be clear about that engagement. So, you know, we as an organization, of course, would not want to be tone deaf to, you know, government policy in any length, but important to note that the government is, of course, a shareholder, not a manager of the business. So in our communications, really at two levels, just to understand where they intend to take electricity policy or hydro policy for the province, which we see in the long-term energy plan, and which is, you know, of course, focused on innovation and opportunities that we see there. Secondly is the work that we've done with the current government, which when you think about the Fair Hydro Plan, which is reduced power by 25 cents for every customer and 31% for Hydro One customers, done and completed after our first meeting within 14 days is a rather extraordinary outcome, which is a $3 billion per annum reduction. Then the affordability plan, which was $200 million that was deposited in Hydro One's account because we're the administrator of that program, and then a change and reduction in the distribution charges. Those are really illustrations of the level of collaboration and effect our organizations had constructively on the relationship. But then going to the second part, which gets to, again, your question, is there's no doubt that hydro or electricity policy is going to be debated, and the two levels are, one is the privatization of Hydro One, which, of course, is, I'll use the word noise, in the marketplace, and I think we all as commercial people realize that that's done, complete, and this organization is fully functioning, operating, and even has its first acquisition underway. So that's sort of a legacy debate and argument that is probably going to get some profile. And then, of course, the Fair Hydro Plan, which is some debate between different branches of opposition and current government, simply around how it's going to get paid for, which the finance department is dealing with, which is outside of our purview. So I would just sum it up to say there will be, let's use the word noise, in the marketplace related to hydro. I don't think in any way it's going to affect our commercial operations. I think that all parties have admired the work that's been done in this organization to both be effective and successful commercially, and also to have a very positive public improvement of relationship. So I would say our customer relationships are at an all-time high in the history of this company. Even the work that we're doing, which you might say is, you know, our corporate social responsibility, has resulted in a record low accounts receivable. So people are paying more bills than they ever have. Our receivables are at the lowest level that we've ever experienced. Relationships are at the highest level. Our billing accuracy is at the highest level. And yes, there is noise, but I think it's the feedback we have, this is not personal to Hydro One. It just simply is the politics of what resulted in an $11 billion global adjustment that weighs on the shoulders of every resident that's been a case of policy for the last 10 years. So hopefully that's a nice purview of what we see is what will be, you know, sort of an election outcome. And following that, we just think the conversation around hydro is going to diminish significantly.
That's great context. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for the question, Linda.
Thank you. And I am showing no further questions from our phone lines. I would now like to turn the conference back over to Omar Javed for closing remarks.
Thank you, Crystal. The management team here at Hydro One thanks everyone for investing their time with us this morning. We appreciate your interest, and to the extent you have any questions that weren't answered, please feel free to reach out and we'll get them answered for you. Thank you again and enjoy the rest of your day.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for participating in today's conference. This does conclude the program, and you may all disconnect. Everyone have a wonderful day.